Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome. I think I've given the appropriate lag time for everybody to make their way down from the other end of the building.
Not yet.
Not yet.
There's a couple of stragglers.
You know how it is? It's always the people who live closest who are the last ones.
Because they live closest.
That's right, yeah.
People ask us.
There, Marilyn helped. We're set now. Well, welcome to, what is this? Week four. See what I did there? Week four of Building the Good Life for All, Transforming Income Inequality in Our Communities. We looked last week at the first of our four strategies for transforming income inequality. We looked at relief, which is sort of the direct charitable aid that we can offer to folks. Looked at some of the ways that that is obviously helpful, some of the more complicated ways that it can be problematic. And I sent you home, this is your segue from last week to this week, I sent you home with the question, how might aid workers' responses change if they, the aid workers, being we who sort of are positioned in a way that lets us dispense the charity, if we saw ourselves as broken alongside the victims of the disaster, the crisis, whatever the situation may be. So how do we, how would our responses change if we recognized that it's not just them, the people we're helping, that are broken, but that we ourselves are broken? So, we're going to turn this week, and just kind of carry that question with you as we turn to this week, our second strategy, which is self-help. So this is the strategy of teaching a man to fish. So on the one hand, relief, kind of getting somebody through whatever crisis they're in. This is to ideally prevent crises in the future. The second strategy we discuss is self-help, also called self-development or self-determination. In both of these first two strategies, relief and self-help, the people developing their abilities benefit from the assistance of others. However, self-help is preferable when the situation does not have the same immediacy or short duration that appropriately calls for relief. One must have both capacities and opportunities to achieve a decent standard of living. You need capacities and you need opportunities. If one does not have any capacities, or not any capacities, he didn't say that. If one does not have capacities or any means of developing them, and if there are no opportunities to earn a living, then one winds up living in poverty with a job that perpetuates one's asset limited status. Inequalities develop in these ways. So if you can't, if you don't have the capacities or you don't have the opportunities to move ahead, you wind up stuck in a place that that perpetuates inequality. Central to the American dream is the notion that hard work will pay off. Skip a lot there. I hope that was not terribly important as a summary for you. But the idea is that we should be able to make a difference to our own scenario. And so the question is, what do we need in order to be able to change our own situation? Being able to make a contribution to ourselves and to the society around us is one of our essential needs as human beings. It's important to have something to give, and in self-help programs, what someone has to give is effort. There is a continuum of the mixture of subsidy or relief elements and self-help contributions by participants. So there's going to be kind of a range of, some of these are going to look a lot more like relief, but we'll make the case that they're self-help. Some of these are going to look a lot more like, okay, let's work together to directly build your capacities. He begins with one continuously controversial program that mixes relief and self-help is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. SNAP is the acronym there, or food stamps is still a common way to refer that. That's not what it's officially called anymore. Shannon says, the evidence suggests that SNAP has been effective in reducing the number of food insecure households so that recipients could work. Women in particular had higher earnings, higher income, higher educational attainment, and less reliance on welfare assistance in general as a result of having received SNAP benefits. For these reasons, it seems that SNAP is as much a program promoting self-help as it is relief. So the idea is that, and the statistics seem to bear this out, that if you meet a household's food needs, they find that that household would end up with higher earnings, higher income. Remember, earnings and income are not the same thing. Higher educational attainment and less reliance on welfare assistance overall. So there's a, you can see the mixture of relief and self-help there. The next area of developing self-help that Shannon turns to is housing. That housing is a vital component of self-help. He points to Habitat for Humanity as perhaps the best known self-help program. The phrase that has become synonymous with Habitat is sweat equity, recognizing that those who have a stake in their own development and achievement of a stable living situation are more committed to it. He then turns to self-help through education. He points to Starbucks, which offers tuition reimbursement for all its baristas who work more than 20 hours a week. Between 1970 and 2012, the proportion of 24-year-olds with a bachelor's degree rose from 40% to 73% among those from affluent families, but only from 6% to 8%. Among those from low-income families. So the gap widened substantially in terms of educational attainment based on the economic status of your family of origin. Starbucks wanted to change that, knowing that their workforce is predominantly coming from that lower asset group of people. Two things were key for Starbucks in helping baristas achieve a bachelor's degree. One is the use of coaches who help the student negotiate the FAFSA forms, the financial aid forms, teach time management skills, and handle bureaucratic snafus that many middle-class parents and students already know how to handle. The second key is when the program was not achieving the expected level of success, the program asked the Starbucks student employees what was impeding it. Starbucks and Arizona State University, which is the educational partner there, then modified the program. The program director, the director of the Starbucks Arizona State program said, the concept of listening to students and then making structural changes based on their feedback remains unheard of at most colleges. Colleges are starting to figure that out, but slowly. So Starbucks not only coached their student employee students in navigating the way college things work, but also asked those students what the problems were and made structural changes to the program based on what they needed. So we had just this sort of really quick, you can see the shift from a more relief-centered approach that has a lot of self-help dynamic to it up through one that is predominantly self-help, shifting from SNAP through through housing benefits, through education. So that shift toward more work by the recipient of the aid and a greater shift toward self-help rather than relief. But you can see how they're connected. So what makes a social program that works? A growing body of evidence shows that a few model social programs, home visits to vulnerable families, K through 12 education, pregnancy prevention, community college, and employment training produce solid impacts that can last for many years. One characteristic stands out over and over again, so much so that it must be noted. People must have a hand in deciding their own fate. Investing oneself and contributing to the decision-making characterizes successful programs. Sometimes the best people to provide information and care in a self-development project are those who understand the situation because they are there themselves. ALICE and ALEC, remember those are our acronyms for people who are asset limited, incomes constrained, and employed. ALICE and ALEC are organizing themselves to create networks of support, and that multiplies the impact of the work that is done. And that strategy of self-help, as we talk about organizing networks of support, as we talk about investment by those who are benefiting from a program, that all points toward the third strategy that we'll talk about next week, which is influencing cultural values. So there's your Zoom summary of this chapter about self-help as an approach. So this may take us a little bit back through the material, but that'll probably be good because that was really fast. When is self-help a more effective strategy than relief? And what are the situational factors that make that difference? What characterizes a situation where you'd say, yeah, self-help is a better approach here than that direct charitable relief?
Well, the immediate crisis, you know, must be resolved. I mean, if you don't have housing, they're going to be in a situation where they have food and housing, so they're at a point where they can go out and get the education or find a job.
Yeah, immediate basic needs have to be met already. So whether that's housing or our food, or you know, you have to be out of the medical crisis before you can get back to school or whatever the case may be.
If the result is an improvement in the economic situation of the recipient, then that's
right. So
that's a definite advantage.
Right. So if you can. If you can characterize the effect of what you're doing as a material change in the recipient's economic situation, which is not always the case in a relief strategy, right? In a relief strategy, if you come to the food pantry and we give you a bag of groceries for the month, but next month you still need another bag of groceries, we haven't materially changed your situation. We may have alleviated an immediate crisis, and that's a really valuable thing. But then it's another step to say, okay, we think we can in fact change your on the ground economic situation. What are some drawbacks of a self-help approach? We talked a little bit last week about relief and the way that relief can be problematic. There's a phrase, toxic charity, that characterizes the way that relief can actually build dependence rather than building independence. Are there ways that self-help can be toxic? Not necessarily in that same way, but are there ways that self-help can be toxic or other drawbacks to it?
This point is more related to what situations are positive for self-help. Is the person able, and does the person have enough supports to take advantage of self-help mm-hmm. and sustain it? So I think that's a really, you have to look at resources, and then you have to look at resources to continue to support
right.
self-help. Is there a counselor, is there an advisor, that follow-up is, I think follow-up is really important.
Right. I was really inspired by the coaching approach that Starbucks and ASU were engaging with, that there was this direct partnership between folks who knew how to navigate college and folks who didn't know how to navigate college but needed to. So that way of actually getting on board with someone as they're developing their skills. Is anybody uneasy at all about the idea of send them to college as a self-help approach?
Maybe that's not going to, in the end, get them a job. I mean, or something. You know, they have the skill level may not be there for the college level, but you know, maybe they're more towards a job that, you know, electrician, you know, something of that sort, plumber, some kind of
job
like that. They aren't going to be able to make it through college.
Right.
It's not going to get them.
Right. There are people who either educationally are not, college is not the right educational setting for them, or are really better prepared for or better suited for some other kind of job that would that really doesn't call for a college education. There has been a tendency as that percentage of affluent people with college degrees went from 40% to 73%. There has been a lot of sort of qualification inflation. That you need a college degree in order to get your foot in the door at jobs that honestly don't require the skills that you picked up at college, right? Which is not to say that we should focus not going to college on people who are from lower economic brackets, right? But rather that there's a complicated layer to that idea, which I think is one of those drawbacks of a self-help approach, that if we say, this is the way you need to help yourself, right? If we say, this is the way to move forward, you're not necessarily actually assisting people in moving forward.
Well, another thing you agree with that is people who, I mean, they've got a job, and they also have benefits on the side, you know, to get through, and then maybe the government raises the wages up as required, so then they cut. So those people don't want those $15 an hour jobs because it means they're going to get cut off from the other benefits they have, and they can't get along without that.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to need to keep that in mind, especially in 2 weeks when we talk about advocacy and governmental action. That to the extent that a lot of these sort of basic needs supports are governmentally administered, which they wouldn't have to be, right? There might be other ways to do that. That's a great argument to have, and find a best way to administer those benefits. But if we administer those benefits in a way that makes it hard to move from $7.25 to $15 an hour, remembering that a survival wage in Iowa is $16 an hour, for two incomes for a family of four, that if we make it hard to move from minimum wage to a survival wage, because you lose some of the benefits that make the survival wage or make that in between actually work, then yeah, self-help can actually become a problem. That's awful, right? You know, it's one thing to say, oh, charity's a problem. Even self-help can be a problem in that way. So keep that in mind in 2 weeks. Okay, I really blasted through the argument about SNAP as self-help. And I said, the statistics bear me out, just go with it. Those of you who read, you might be more or less convinced by the statistics there. But consider either SNAP, which gives a certain amount toward your grocery bill based on family size. That's how SNAP is structured. When you meet a certain, fall below a certain income ceiling, and there are work requirements for most SNAP recipients already, in addition to any work requirements that are otherwise contemplated. Work or disability requirements. So consider SNAP, or consider free modest housing. And if you've ever been into, for instance, a Habitat for Humanity home, two things about that. One, it's modest. And it's often much more modest than we could picture raising a family of the size that is moving into that home. And the second thing is it's not actually free, right? It's greatly discounted because the down payment is made by 400 hours of sweat equity on the part of the family, and the mortgage is interest-free. So it's greatly discounted relative to what it would cost on the market to purchase the same home, but it's not free. Imagine free housing. Something very exciting just happened in the world. But consider even free housing. Definitely consider Habitat. Consider SNAP. Do those make sense to you as programs that are ultimately about self-help? Or does that argument fall apart for you?
Well, I think the Habitat model definitely is helpful because the sweat equity teaches the individual or the family some things about maintenance, mm-hmm. which they need to know if they own a home. And the fact that the mortgage is interest-free, but still they need to gradually pay it off, mm-hmm. Is an incentive to better oneself. And if their income and their salary does improve, it doesn't hit a cliff where the thing suddenly the assistant suddenly falls off.
Right, and nobody from Habitat comes and says, congratulations on your promotion, we want the house back. Yeah.
Or the loan paid off right now.
Right, yeah. Yeah, those are very good points. So Habitat is a program that works very hard to avoid that cliff. It also is a program that tends not to be directed toward people who are currently living unsheltered. Usually the way that their criteria are structured is you have to be in inadequate housing, but inadequate housing is typically still a structure, but you don't have enough rooms for your family, or the apartment is unhealthy, which that's a really common one. And you have to be, you have to have enough income to realistically be able to pay off the mortgage at the level that it will come. So yeah, there's a lot of structure in there. So Habitat's up on a higher tier there. Yeah.
Part of using the Habitat example, there's also contingencies that are there. mm-hmm. that if you're gonna get the house, you must do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna keep the house, you must do certain things. So mm-hmm. you're also, that also gets into the, maybe the cultural change too, mm-hmm. that I need to plan ahead,
mm-hmm.
which people have not had the opportunity to develop those kinds of skills or the
context.
Reason to actually do it. So
right.
some of those things, they blend. But when you say self, well, if I don't do the painting myself, then there's not much self-help involved.
Mm-hmm.
It turns into the relief.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, as soon as you talk about relief strategies, relief is, it tends to be rather simple. It's food, it's mm-hmm. shelter, it's something else. Self-help becomes terribly messy,
yeah.
because what they need assistance on changes
mm-hmm.
rather than being stable the entire time.
Right. Yeah, so there's this long process of kind of building and developing, okay, what do you need to develop next as you develop your capacities? Yeah.
Even selecting the families.
Right, yeah.
For the recipients of the homes is not simple. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time to get through the 400 hours, and there is coursework about
yeah.
changing the cultural things and how to mm-hmm. save for the payments.
Right.
And there's some mm-hmm. classwork for it too, and then you hit language barriers and other mm-hmm. things come up that make it messier too.
Yeah.
It's a long process, though. It's not
yeah.
something you have two kids and you can get through this.
Yeah.
It's
right.
hard.
Yeah.
I think the same is true for the Presbyterians and the disaster assistance or self-help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a long process to apply, and then all those applications have to be considered, and not everybody gets the self-help, as I understand it. Is that your understanding?
Certainly in say, Presbyterian disaster assistance, there's always more need out there than we can meet. And I would say, sort of as I said last week, PDA tries to leave people in a position where they can really be sustainable going forward. I struggle to make the case that PDA is primarily self-help rather than primarily a relief because of that word disaster. But in terms of partnering with people on the ground, PDA tries to, maybe the thing you could say is that they try to have self-help at the community level and then relief at the individual level. So they try to work with existing infrastructures that are there, existing agencies, existing presbytery networks. But that's one where I would say that's probably, if we're going to say SNAP is a relief program that contributes to self-help, PDA is even more relief. Sort of they're even a step farther on the relief end of that spectrum than, say, SNAP is.
I think the church has really done a good job differentiating and having two separate agencies, you know,
mm-hmm.
PDA, Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, and then the self-help.
Right.
So you find that people within each of those programs are geared to maximize that approach.
Right. So at our mission festival, one of the giving opportunities that we gave people was Self-Development of People, which is a Presbyterian church fund that basically does startup grants for community programs, organizations. They might be business ventures, they might be job training ventures, they might be, they sort of anything that's going to help a community develop itself. But that self-development is critical to what that program is about. And so some of the qualifications for that are that the program has to be initiated by and led by people who will benefit from the program. So if say there was to be a job training program attached to a homeless shelter, which there's something that would make a lot of sense, right? And those sorts of things exist. To get funding from self-development of people to begin that, expand that, whatever particular funding you need for that program right now, the initiative for that needs to come from people who are homeless who would benefit from that job training program, and they need to sit on the board. They need to actually be directly able as members of that of the beneficiary group. They also need to be in control of the program. Maybe not exclusive control of the program. There are lots of reasons to also have other stakeholders, for instance, on a board of directors of something like that. They have to be well represented. The beneficiaries of the program need to be well represented in the leadership of the program. That's part of the self-development of people.
I think one of the things you're hitting on is what Starbucks and Arizona University of Arizona, mm-hmm. whichever it is, have discovered. I was hearing about a program last night where they were trying to rebuild a city, an area of Louisville, Kentucky. And instead of just going in and having investors and developers just go in and do it, they are knocking on doors and bringing in the people that currently live in this city area to sit down and talk and say, what do you need? What would make you invest? And I think that's the biggest thing on most of these programs. They're all set on the criteria of what people in our economic and further up in government decide it's going to be. Two examples of that right now is one of them where it's, I believe it's in the legislature, where they're talking about having to have people go to work and get a job to get Medicaid. Mm. The second thing that I've been hearing about was, for example, during the shutdown, when our great, whichever one he was, the cabinet decided that everybody should just go get a loan to pay for their food. Why do you need to go to the shelters? That's ridiculous. We all can go and get a loan. Yeah, right. So. Well, if you're a multi-billionaire, I don't think you even need a loan, so you wouldn't know how to do it. And secondly, it's still set on his criteria of, well, they know that you'll get a paycheck. I just find that they don't fit together, and you need to find out, even on the self-help, you've just indicated some of the things that is going to be better because of it, because you're incorporating the people that need the help. And when they make their own investment in it, I think they would be more, and also knowing what it is that it's going to answer for them to go to their life, I think it would be more of a successful program.
So I can just as easily poo-poo the idea that federal employees should go get loans rather than getting paychecks. which, to my mind, the question is, why are they not being paid? Obviously, we're open now, we're open Monday. I don't know when we're open, but so that one seems to, that one seems to specifically call for, if you've been furloughed and you are legally prohibited from using your specialized job skills in another employment capacity, which is actually part of the matter of mm-hmm. being furloughed, or you are being required to use your specialized job skills in your original employment and just not being paid for it, that's a crisis, right? That calls for, on the one hand, that calls for relief in the immediate term, and it calls for justice in the bigger term, right? So I'm going to call that strategy one and strategy four, and set that aside because we're on strategy two today.
The
work requirement for Medicaid. The work requirement for Medicaid is that's an interesting one to me because that does get into this question of what's the line or the continuum between relief and self-help, right? In what ways, kind of back to this one, what are some drawbacks of a self-help approach, and how can self-help be toxic? If self-help becomes a hoop that you have to jump through in order to meet a basic need, right? If self-help becomes a hoop that you have to jump through in order to meet a basic need, then we've got a problem. I will also say that in my experience interacting with people who are unable to work, who have been unable to find work, by and large, the people I know really want jobs. By and large, the people I know really would like to be employable. And I know some people who are just plain not employable. And maybe they could become employable. I would love for that to happen for them. But I definitely know people who are not employable. So it's difficult to craft a requirement, especially once we start using a word like requirement. It's difficult to craft a requirement that says, okay, we'll help you, but only under these circumstances. And I would say, good luck to any of us getting a job when we don't have adequate health, right? And it's hard for most all of us to achieve adequate health when we don't have adequate health care. So huge questions to wrestle with around something like Medicaid, which also lands, that's going to come back for us under the governmental advocacy and governmental support. But the question of, is that entirely a relief thing, or is that actually a foundation for self-help? I would encourage us to see that as a foundation for self-help, however we get adequate, affordable health care to people. I heard that's complicated to deal with health care, but however we get adequate, affordable health care to people, that's going to give a foundation for self-help. Now, how do we help Alice or Alec while leaving them in control of their own trajectories? How do we help them to develop themselves while actually letting them develop themselves and letting them know they know best how they ought to develop themselves?
I think of the general operating system with our partner village in mm-hmm. El Salvador is any petition comes from their elected board, their directiva. Mm-hmm. And we don't offer or give anything that doesn't come through them, whether it's a relief, like in the current situation with drought and they don't have food, mm-hmm. or if it's for water, a water tank, where they're trying to get a self-development sort of thing. Everything comes from them. Mm-hmm. What is it that it's called? A solicitude?
Solicitude.
Right. Yeah. And we wait for the elected board to petition either type of help.
Right. And even in the situation where we were like chomping at the bit to provide some direct food assistance, we also throttled ourselves back and said, okay, we are ready to do this as soon as we get a request that it be done, right? Because it's easy for us to see, oh my goodness, a drought, a crop failure, and it's awful. For subsistence farming, if you lose a crop, that is a massive crisis, right? If I go to the grocery store and I drop the eggs on the way in the door, that's not a crisis, that's a mess. But if I am growing the corn and beans that I need to survive and they fail, that's a crisis. And still, we were careful to say, we're not gonna do that to them, we're going to wait for them to ask for it. Which is a hard balance, and it takes a lot of trust, actually, between the parties in order to say, we're ready with this, would you like it, essentially? And to know that they might say no.
I can remember one delegation visit where an engineer type person saw that there was definitely things they could do to move water and keep it and be more sustainable. And he came back and he was just, you know, just almost just pent up with, why can't they do this? But he, it wasn't more than a year later that the village figured that out and the petition came and we all celebrated.
That's right.
But it was hard because you want to go in and fix it.
Right. And I keep hearing Mark Hilliard in the back of my mind saying that place is an NGO graveyard. That the number of attempted projects that have been sort of thrown at this post-colonial world, right? And so ways of essentially recolonizing El Salvador or other parts of the world, because I'm sure I know the answer, right? I don't necessarily know the answer in that context.
Who knows what Brubaker School is? It's a school off the freeway down by Methodist Hospital. That's the Oak Ridge neighborhood.
You mean Edmonds?
Yeah, Edmonds, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. When Edmonds was built, it was built with a touch of federal community development money that had to bring in people from the neighborhood to plan what they wanted in the way of school and so forth. And in talking to the guy that was responsible for doing that and working with that community, I asked him, what was the essential ingredient that let those people come together? And he said, money and the opportunity to make decisions. Because it's one thing to sit around and talk about what would be good. It's something else. Now you've got the resources. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was saying that was the empowering event right there, that people had responsibility for this money. What are we going to do?
Right.
And that seems to be what, you know, the same thing with El Salvador, that type of opportunity.
They know that we fundraise and that we have some funds available and would do more fundraising if we need it. They know that, and so they can think through their crises or situations and make proposals. And we respond one way or another. Would you say that?
To have full disclosure here, I think it's only fair to say that we do not approve or accept or fund all requests, all solicitudes.
Right.
And it's interesting, to me anyway, what they have on their list of high priority. I think one was they wanted a full-time doctor in the clinic in San Ysidro.
Mm-hmm.
Another was they wanted a student requested that we finance his college education so he could be a teacher and return to San Ysidro. So we don't have the wherewithal or the inclination, maybe, to always approve every solicitude. And I just wanted to get that
that's good.
On the record.
Right. And that's part of that mutual trust, right?
Yeah.
So they can send us solicitudes that we might say no to, or not right now to, or we can't. And we can trust that there will still be another solicitude coming. And even if there's not another solicitude coming, that there's still a partnership there. What would that look like here? One of the things that I hear from people who are not super enthused about the San Ysidro Partnership is the sort of the charity begins at home idea, or the, you know, why can't we help people across town rather than around the world? To which my flip response is always, go do it, right? On the other hand, what would that look like? What would it look like to have that same kind of partnership, that same kind of relationship with some autonomous group or autonomous set of people that preserves their autonomy, but it happens here?
Here as in this particular church, or here as the in the community?
Covenant with some facet of the community. Whether covenant in our relationships with individuals, or covenant in a relationship with a community within the Des Moines area, what would that look like? Or is there a reason we can't do the same kind of model here?
I'm not really up to speed or knowledgeable about the Community Foundation, but they have been very generous to our San Ysidro appeals. And I, as I understand it, it's people who want to make donations to good causes but are willing to entrust others to decide how their donated funds should be distributed. I think that's what the Community Foundation is. And like I say, we have been benefactors of some wonderful, wonderful gifts. So there is something in that in terms of, I'm sure they're turning down, they're not honoring every request they get.
Right.
And that's a tough board to be on, who you accept and who you reject. But I don't know if that's what you're talking about in terms of a place for appeals to be sent and hope for financing.
Well, I think that's an interesting model for it. And it calls for a certain, like that sort of falls at a certain tier of sort of level of organization and scale of project. What would it look like for Covenant to have a relationship locally, or is there a reason we can't have a relationship locally that is like our relationship with San Ysidro?
You'd have to find a group that was very organized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be a lot of work to figure out.
Right.
A lot of money, too.
And a lot of money.
More money
than San Ysidro?
Kind of the organizational stuff you were talking about? Because people that are low income, especially in the Des Moines area, they move so much. There isn't a community. You know, San Ysidro is easy because they don't move in and out very much. You take Oak Ridge Apartments. They're there 2 months, they're gone. They're back in Oak Ridge 4 months later, then they're gone. And then they're back, and then they're gone. And they jump around between all the low-income housing units, sometimes because they're being evicted and then reaccepted and back and forth like that. But I think it's really hard to find a community because it's so mobile. And so that's where, like, the organizations are kind of helpful. Because it puts some structure to it, but to adopt a community, it's going to be a revolving door of the actual people you're serving.
Mm-hmm.
But that means we just redefine maybe the organization. It might not be the person, it might be the location we're serving.
Right.
And that kind of changes the thought process then on what kind of support then are you offering that location.
Right.
There's so many other groups they're doing.
And there's a lot of
similar
other
things.
Right,
how do you
exactly
find the niche?
But a lot of the other organizations are really looking at the people, not a location.
Yes,
and there's
true.
Plenty
yeah,
of places
true.
In West Des Moines that are very underserved, like Vista Apartments. And honestly, the bus system in Des Moines stinks. So just transportation alone would be something that, you know, we could focus on, or one part of supporting that community, even though it's not the same people day in and day out. And I think that's how we kind of have to change our idea of support a little bit.
Then you're giving up relationship,
right?
And going more for serving an area.
Right.
What you're
mm-hmm.
suggesting.
Right. Exactly.
And maybe with some, you have to get more focused on what your service is going to be.
Right.
Right.
Because you can't serve everything.
Right.
You know, that would
right.
be daunting.
And I think what you're putting it down to Covenant itself, the issue often becomes, I mean, the people we have within our own congregation,
right,
that serve with San Ysidro, mm-hmm, they still look for people that will take the trip,
mm-hmm,
and they're also a bigger unit, because your entire group is with all the Presbyterian churches, isn't
right
it? I don't know if it reaches beyond that or not, but so you're not just talking about certain people
right
that
right
deal with that. So,
so
I think we're kind of small.
Right, so who we are is a different resource question.
We have to be interacting with somebody else.
Right. Okay, I'm going to let that sit there for the week. If you're a reader, chapter 5, which is about 20 pages, strategy 3 is cultural formation. So beyond the things we directly do, how do we shape the culture around us? So we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.